Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World Thursday webinar on the 4th of June 2020. I'm your host, Tamsin Freeman, and today I'm delighted to be joined by David Stevenson, also known as the Adventurous Investor, from his column for the Financial Times. David, many thanks indeed for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me on. Hope you find informative in the next hour.
I'm sure we will. So can you tell us a bit about your background, including when you first started investing and your investing journey, as well as a bit about your career background?
Well, I'll get the boring career background. I'm one of those ex-TV lovers. So I worked for many, many years at the BBC in business and finance, and some of your listeners will be old enough to remember a program called The Money Programme, which I was senior producer on, very long time ago now. And then became a kind of media entrepreneur. So I've run TV companies and internal communications companies. And one of my current businesses is a publishing business, which is actually in a related space, which is in, well, two of them, fintech, all around the kind of fintech world, a business called Altfi, altfi.com. And then another one called ETF Stream, which is all around asset management. And I think the clue's in the title, which is exchange trade funds. And that segues into, I'm quite funds orientated. As a journalist, I've always written for lots and lots of kind of investment publications. I've been a Financial Times columnist for, I look back at some old clippings now, about 12, 13 years. I also write columns for CityWire and Money Week. But I pretty much exclusively write about funds. And that's largely because many, many years ago, when I was much younger, many less grey hairs, I used to invest in individual stocks. This would be way back in the 1990s, mid-90s, and rapidly learned I wasn't very good at it, and made lots and lots and lots of mistakes. I learned from many of those mistakes, and one of the things I learned from them, which is stock picking is a bit of a mug's game in my book. And then I ended up writing loads and loads of stuff about stock screening for the Investors Chronicle way back in the late 90s. So set up all their stock screens to try and be more systematic and methodical in the way I picked shares. And then worked out that actually even that I was probably not good enough to do. So I decided, well, I'm mostly just do funds. And so by and large now, I run my own SIP, I run my own ISAs, all that kind of normal stuff. I'm pretty much kind of like 80% funds. I do invest in stocks every once in a while. But I usually invest in stocks if I think that they're a kind of a proxy for a wider trend. So I've made really good profits in the last couple of months on things like NVIDIA, the big GPU microprocessor business in the States, well, actually Taiwan technically, and AMD. But because I think they're proxies for, in that respect, cloud server software and gaming software. So I would invest in individual stocks, but I'm not really much of a stock picker. I'm rubbish. And I definitely don't do kind of UK small mid caps. I would much rather pick managers who know what they're doing. People like, you know, Gervais Williams and Gary Channon and all that kind of stuff that's their job doing it all the time. So I definitely don't do any UK small caps, but I'm quite investment trust focused and to a lesser degree ETF focused. So I don't really tend to invest in mutual funds, unit trusts. Mainly because I do it all myself, so I'm much happier using investment trusts. And then I sort of flip back and forth between ETFs and investment trusts.
And why the adventurous investor? Where did that come from?
I don't know. Long time ago, and I don't even remember what the reason was. I do quite like off the beaten track stuff. I like alternative stuff. I mean, I do like everybody invest in mainstream stuff, but I do like finding stuff that's a little bit different. Preferably uncorrelated or less than completely correlated with the main markets. And I do think it's less so than it used to be, that alternatives are a very good way in which investors can, as I said, diversify their portfolio. The reason I say less so than it used to be, because a lot of the alternatives that I've championed for many, many years have become very mainstream now. So to the point at which, you know, even litigation finance, I was right about Burfa Capital 15 years ago. It's obviously had a few problems recently, but that's pretty mainstream now, you know, well, as mainstream as you can get in alternatives. Infrastructure, I've championed for many, many years, now trades at premium. So I've always liked alternative stuff. I've always liked geographically diverse stuff. So I think that if you bother to do your research and you can track down individual national markets or sectors that are interesting, they're absolutely worth it. And traditionally, I've done quite well out of that. So, but you have to do the hard work and, you know, due diligence. So that's where it comes from.
So before we move on to what you've been doing investing-wise, let's talk about the market generally. It's extremely strong at the moment, seems to be pricing in a V-shaped recovery. What are your views?
Well, I think John Authors, who writes a very good column, I think Points of Return for Bloomberg, it puts it very well that this is probably the most unloved market rally in history. And I think he's probably right. The most hated, I think. Oh, my dog's just started to bark. The most hated rally in history. And I will freely admit that I'm very heavily cash. Yeah, so I don't buy the market rally. I liquidated large bits of my positions about two and a half weeks ago. The market seems to be what I think is, it, and I may be wrong, and in fact, I probably am wrong, it is in irrational mode. The rational investors like to say that the market is a kind of weighing machine based on long-term or medium-term forecasts, and therefore the market's pricing back in a recovery. But MSCI analysts put together a really neat note. You can find it on my blog, adventurousinvestor.com. And they sort of looked at macroeconomic variables and then charted it back to the various kind of recoveries that everybody's expecting, you know, a U-shaped recovery, a V-shaped recovery, I think they call it a swoosh, which I call W, and then L. And they basically said the market at the moment is absolutely pricing back in a V-shaped recovery. And I personally think the market's on a wacky-backy, personally. I don't see any evidence of that whatsoever. And again, I've written columns about this for FT and Citywire. We're only in the second order of the after effects of the COVID crisis. Something like over 35% of the UK employed workforce is now dependent on furlough schemes or SME schemes or is unemployed. And then we add back in public sector employers and probably for half the entire working population is now paid for by the government. And they are going to be massive knock-on effects in the economy, sort of second, third and fourth order effects. So I'm very, very bearish. I don't buy it at all. I don't think it's rational.
So with your W-shaped recovery, what sort of GDP do you think will be sort of slightly stop-starty, or are you thinking we're going to have another lockdown, or what's that factoring in and what's that looking like?
Yes, I think we will have another lockdown. I mean, fingers crossed we don't have a second wave. I'd love it if we didn't. I think it's absolutely fabulous. Maybe the people saying that the virus is, you know, burning itself out, maybe they're right. I don't know. I don't know nothing about. I'm not a medic or an epidemiologist. My concern is less second, a kind of another wave, but actually the knock-on economic effects and the political effects. We're already seeing massive impacts on emerging markets and developing world. Renaissance Capital do very good kind of monitor on third world and sort of developing world impacts on COVID. And, you know, we already know Brazil is in desperate, desperate trouble. India's next, Egypt probably, so there's emerging market knock-on effects. And we're already seeing from the Black Lives Matter protests that the socioeconomic impact of kind of people just generally being pissed off about stuff is going to, I think, amplify over the next year. There's an awful lot. There will be a lot of pissed off people out there, and they'll probably have good reason to be pissed off. And that has economic and political effects. So actually, my argument for the W-shaped is less a second wave of infection, which may or may not happen, I don't know, but that that the economic impact and political impact will be absolutely phenomenal. And all it takes is for some knowable unknown. So classic example is, you know, China has taken the word peaceful out of its transition ideas for Taiwan and hasn't quite inserted we shall invade you yet. But if they were to really, you know, ratchet up that is the kind of thing that would throw the markets into turmoil. So the markets are pricing in V-shaped recovery. I don't think it is going to be a V-shaped recovery. I think that the markets are not pricing in geopolitical risk and economic risk. And I think that I think if you sold in May and came back in September, October, I'm sure there's an expression that goes with that. Then I think you're probably, it's not a bad strategy.
So if we look at your investing over the COVID period, how were you positioned at the start of the year and how's that changed to today?
Well, I have to write a column most weeks for CityWise, and I have to sort of say what I'm invested in, so there's no hiding from me. So I was about early February, I was about 30% in cash. I was a bit cautious then anyway. I was growing more positive and bullish about UK equities, which I thought were undervalued, and I still think they probably are. But I was running 30% because I thought the market looked a bit toppy then. And then going into the meltdown, like all of us, I got probably caught short, but I managed to sort of get out reasonably early and went back to cash. And then
100% cash?
No, probably about at that point 70% cash. And then I went quite aggressively back in and went back up to 100% equity. I can't remember when it was now. Probably about the second week of March. So I think about two or three days before volatility peaked on March the 12th, I was 100% equities. And I basically went very long UK mid-caps, but more aggressively Scottish mortgage, tech stocks. I felt that tech was probably a safer place to be. I've always been an investor in Scottish mortgage anyway. I think James Anderson's excellent. Tom Slater is good as well. And went 100% equity. And then a week and a half ago, sold out all of those positions. No, 2.5 weeks ago, sold out all those positions. And I'm probably back now. Cash is probably running at about 50, 60%. There's some stuff I can't sell. Like I'm director in a couple of boards and looks a bit bad if you sell stuff. I've also got some stuff that's that is difficult to sell because it's a bit adventurous and actually is doing fine. When I say 100% cash, I probably was actually more 90% cash. I've always got about 10 or 15%, something like that, that I find very difficult to sell for all sorts of reasons.
So you said you were 30% cash at the end of February. Did you mean the end of January?
Yes, I meant the end of January. So yeah.
And what were the catalysts? How did you have the foresight to sell at the end of January?
Well, I didn't have the foresight. I just basically thought that the market was toppy then, basically. There's Robert Shiller, the American economist, does a very good chart. Google Robert Shiller data room, which is the cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, CAPE, for US equities. And it's absolutely useless as a short-term trigger. But as a long-term a measure of whether or not a market is overvalued, it's very useful. And back at the end of January, it looked pretty damned expensive. And let's be honest, everything is correlated to US equities, whether you like it or not, yeah? So if US investors get very excited, we all get very excited. Sometimes US investors get excited and then British investors don't get excited and UK stocks underperform. But by and large, most markets, developed world markets, are correlated with US equities. And if US equities are overvalued and they start to sell off, then everybody else starts to sell off. It's just that's the way it works. Correlations snap to one in big sell-offs.
And you're looking at PEs when you're talking about valuations.
Yeah, PEs. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And also, you were seeing peak stock share buybacks in America, particularly, and that's usually a pretty contra indicator. If buybacks were being aggressively financed by leverage finance, which is leverage loans, which is usually a pretty good contrarian indicator. And I'm lucky that I get to read a lot of the kind of strategist notes that come out and. You know, some of them were always bearish, like Albert Edwards at Soc Gen. But even people that I respect and trust, people like Graham Secker at Morgan Stanley, who's a good equity analyst, they were getting a bit twitchy. And I just thought, this doesn't look right.
And at the bottom, what were the catalysts to buy? Why didn't you think it might go back to 0.9 levels?
Well, I remember putting in my notebook what I thought would be peak to trough. Moves, yeah. And I felt that a peak to trough of about 45% was about right for what was coming. I think peak to trough, we got to 35, roughly speaking. And one thing I have learned for many years, and having read many Warren Buffett's sage-like pronouncements, that it's very difficult to sort of measure the bottom, you know. So I don't know where the bottom is. I mean, I could have hung around to 45%. I would have actually missed it. So, I mean, I just felt it was a pretty good time to buy. I'm relatively young still. even with all the grey hairs. So I can afford to sit tight for 10, 20 years, you know. So I was happy to go back in. But then I basically felt that the bounce back has been too aggressive. I just think it's completely unwarranted. So that's the reason I sold out.
So what will be the catalyst now for you to start spending that 50 to 60% cash that you've got?
Oh, I'd be looking for a nice proper 20% correction. I mean, you know, the market's it's overpriced. It's just it's not priced realistically. It's a function of central bank liquidity and vast amounts of money sloshing around the economy. And frankly, if I'm honest, and apologies to any Americans might be on the call, bonkers American investors who somehow think that all the stuff that's going wrong is shouldn't really affect stocks. And I personally think they're deluded. So I'd be looking for at the economic level. I would probably not be looking for unemployment to bottom out because that doesn't tell you anything. I'd be looking for pronounced and strong bounce back in spending, consumer spending on things like leisure, Walt Disney, planes, that kind of stuff, where I would cruise liners, where I would be looking for a positive bullish signal, and I ain't seeing any of it yet.
And in retrospect, is there anything that you'd have done differently over the past beginning of the year to now?
No, I'm not that kind of look backwards. No, not really. I mean, I don't claim any great prescience. I went by my gut and did what I probably tell lots of investors not to do, which is market time. But no, not really. I that's not because I think it was perfect. It's just because I don't tend to. I'm quite good at analysing whether or not I'm late to selling. I've instilled that discipline on me. And I suppose if I sat down analytically thought about it, I was probably a bit, I should probably have been 50% probably at the end of January, not 30%. But hey, you know, I mean, you know, what do we know?
And do you see any opportunities today? What will you be looking at once a correction has happened?
Yeah, I've got my watch list of stuff. I'll probably get back into Scottish Mortgage at some point. I've been investing in it for many years. I said I think it's a better price at the moment. I think it's a great fund long term. No. I would actually go back into, and I've written about this in CityWire. I think there's lots of individual thematic trends out there that are really interesting and I would like to buy back into. So one of the things I didn't sell out is I'm still reasonably longish, but biotech and particularly genomics revolution. I think that's the single most profound change that's going to happen to the human race over the next 30 years. And at the moment, it all seems a bit boring because it's all about kind of, you know, genomic drug delivery mechanisms, all that kind of stuff. So I'm in stocks like Syncona, which is Britain's largest life sciences VC. And I think that, you know, I was chatting to my son who's 18, who's interested in shares. And, you know, not that 18-year-olds ever listened to their dad. But I was saying to him that if I were him and his age group, you know, long term, the biotech and genomics story is a fascinating story. It's a very difficult story to buy into on an individual stock level. I have people who work for me on my publications and they buy individual biotech stocks. And I just roll my eyes and just say, have you got a degree in life sciences? Do you really understand this stuff? Which is why I've always gone down the fund route. So pick things like Syncona, which is a fund, or Biotech Growth Trust, which is a fund. So I think genomics is a fantastic story. There's some really important stuff coming down the track there. I also think that the energy transition story, the move to a new grid is really interesting. And there's lots of stuff that's going to fall out of that, particularly around battery technology, that is really interesting. For full disclosure, I'm director on Britain's biggest battery storage listed fund. I also think that the gaming market is a great market. That ain't going away. That is just going to carry on getting bigger and more profitable. And so I wrote about it in CityWire. It's no great surprise. VanEck have got a very good ETF that tracks most of the big gaming related stocks. And then, you know, I think that the whole migration to the cloud, cloud based servers and cloud based software, is a great story. So, you know, some of the position I still got open, even though I liquidated aggressively, is I've still got things like Spotify, which is effectively cloud music. I watch Salesforce aggressively. I think Salesforce is a fantastic business. I like Microsoft. I think it's a fantastic business. You know, the Azure platform, the cloud platform they have is a brilliant, brilliant proposition. So I'd probably go back in tech. And then I've got a watch list of absolute trashed stocks that I will, and I think I might actually in the last week or two have started quietly buying back into them. Trash stocks are things like Ryanair, EasyJet, Carnival Cruises. I wrote about that in the FT. My son thinks cruising is for old farts and is going to die. I think he's wrong. And in fact, I know he's wrong. Because I live in the New Forest near Southampton, which is a big dock area, and I was chatting away to somebody who works for Carnival, and they were telling me that a lot of the cabins that they were looking for to purchase for 2021 season are already sold out, and there's loads and loads of people taking their vouchers and cancelled cruising and going back on. So I like Carnival, I like EasyJet, I like Ryanair, I quite like Melrose Industries. I think they're a smart team, you know, they're absolutely, you know, what a fantastic time to buy GKN, not. But they know what they're up to. They're a fantastic, effectively a great way of buying a bunch of great industrial assets. So, yeah, that's probably a bit on my watch list.
And in your sweet spot of battery storage, what funds give exposure to that?
Well, for full disclosure, I'll tell you mine one. So mine is called, the one which I'm a non-exec director on, which is called GRID, which is Gresham House Energy Storage. And there's another one called Gore Street. I gave the disclosure, I'm non-exec, but genuinely, this is a really important story. And that we will be renewables to 70% within the next 5 years on electricity generation in the UK. I mean, you everybody can have a debate about it, but I'll tell you now that is what is going to happen. And the intermittency of renewables is a phenomenal problem. Already National Grid is having to pay away tens, if not hundreds of millions of pounds to shut capacity when necessary, or tell nuclear power, or basically bribe nuclear power stations to not supply their electricity baseload onto the grid. And the whole area, so as we see renewables increase, and I think we'll be up to 100%, well, 95% renewables in power generation in the UK probably by 2030. So renewables is obviously great, but you've got a massive intermittency problem. And there's where batteries, and there are other energy storage technologies out there, interconnectors and all that kind of stuff, come into their own. And as we move to an electric car economy, maybe a hydrogen car economy, I don't know. I mean, CPS, right-wing think tank, was talking about that today. But as we move to the electric car economy, the question of scheduling power usage is going to change fundamentally. We've already seen it with the shutdown. Grid has been reporting kind of very abnormal peak loads around 4 o'clock or 3:30 in the afternoon, which is very unusual for the grid because they normally tend to sort of do it 7:15 whenever he puts the cup of tea on or puts the TV on. And I think what we'll see is the distribution of power around the day radically change, and that presents real problems for grid and for all grids. So they'll have to get their heads around that. And I think that on a bearish side, my big, big call, and I'm glad I did it, was a year ago, I dumped every single bar one, every single energy stock I had, particularly in oil, because oil is stuffed. It's a goner, you know. And all those investors out there who like buying into E&P stocks, good luck, I say, because you're on a loser. Two or three years ago, I thought the whole divestment movement coming out of the university sector was laughable and just a pointless waste of time. I don't think that any longer now. I talk a lot to institutional investors, and trust me when I say that many big institutions are dumping energy stocks like hotcakes. And they're not dumping them because they've been crap, which they've been. They're dumping them because they have compliance and regulatory and ESG committees on their back every day now about investing in energy. And basically, I think the big energy, well, certainly the medium-sized energy companies, are stuffed. And all this stuff about stranded assets that used to seem a bit laughable, Mark Carney used to talk a lot about it. This is real. And the destruction of value within the energy sector is going to be absolutely monumental. And you may think climate change doesn't exist, or it's not important, or it will be moderate, or it won't affect me, and all those things. I don't want to get into that debate, but I can tell you from a financial perspective, oil companies are stuff.
And popular at the moment is gold. Are you a gold bug? How do you feel about gold funds?
I subscribe to Warren Buffett's argument, which is, you know, if you're Martian looking in on the earth, you'd be wondering what the hell it is that people worry about, like gold. But then I've slightly changed my tune in the last year. And the reason why is to do with central bankers. Yeah. So I have, in answer to your question, Tamsin, I have quietly started buying some gold miners, Newmont and what's the other, Barrick. And the reason I've slight, not much though, but just, you know, nibbling away. The reason I have is that I maintained for a very long time, and I probably still do maintain, that we would be in a low rates for longer environment. So we'd have very low interest rates, not for many years, but for many decades. I still think that's by and large true. And the reason I was sort of very anti-gold on a practical level was is that gold, I think, is fundamentally a bet against central bankers. Yeah. So if you think central bankers can move markets, then you don't bet on gold, because central bankers really don't want gold to do well. And they've got lots of mechanisms that can basically, you know, kill your gold position. So effectively, gold, I think, is a bet against central bankers. And until very recently, I wasn't willing to take that bet. And in fact, we've seen evidence that, you know, central bankers have phenomenal power, particularly when it's combined with fiscal policy. But, and here's a big but, I think that the market's perception that the central bankers have run out of ammunition when the next big upset comes, which, by the way, I don't think is true. I think they have got other weapons in the armory they can use. But that the market's perception that risk, that they've got many weapons left, is growing. And the market's perception that inflation risk from all of the various mechanisms that they've used is growing. Not now, certainly not for the next year and a half, for all the reasons that I have kind of articulated. But 2, 3, 4 years down the line, market perception of that risk of inflation moving above a 2-4% target range to sort of 4-6 and maybe 5-7, the market's perception of that risk, even if the reality of that risk, I think, is probably still fairly low, has, I think, exponentially increased. And I, you know, from a kind of, do you seriously believe that inflation would hit, you know, 6% 1 year ago or 6 months ago? I guess probably institutional investors, 5%, 10% thought that. I would suggest now that 20% think that, 25% think that. And as long as there's enough people nervous and skittish about central banker policy and actions, that will underpin the gold price quite aggressively. And I've also been impressed by the fact that gold has traded quite nicely and actually with relatively low volatility. As an aside, I got very interested a few years ago in cryptocurrencies, and everybody used to excitedly say to me, with my kind of fintech hat on, crypto, you know, Bitcoin is going to be a replacement for gold. No, it isn't. And I'll tell you why it isn't. Because Bitcoin's volatility is just off the Richter scale, whereas gold's volatility is actually not bad. It's actually fairly low. It's actually done sort of what it says. So why do I want a safe haven asset that is massively volatile as opposed to one that's not volatile? So anyway, going back to the thing, I think that the market's perception of that has grown inexorably, and that will underpin gold prices. Gold's been fairly low volatility. It looks pretty steady. And gold miners, you know, make the big ones, particularly low-cost ones, scale ones, are making shitloads of money at prices like they are now. Well, I don't think it's a bad bet. You know, things like, here's an interesting measure. So I was chatting away to a guy called Andrew Lapthorne, who's the chief quant strategist at SocGen, the big French investment bank. And he does a lot of work on equity income strategies, you know, the kind of things that have all fallen out of bed in the last 2-3 months. And we were chatting away. And in one of his screens that he regularly runs, which looks at balance sheet, dividends, all that kind of stuff, mainstream equities, you know, he said, we're seeing more and more gold miners pop in there. You know, so Polymetal, which is actually a Russian-based but London-listed gold miner, you know, is churning out pretty steady, growing dividend, you know, very solid balance sheet. And actually on equity income screens is appearing now. And that, I think, is an interesting story. So I've become less, so I used to be extremely anti-gold, yeah. And I'm, as I said, I still think we've got a low rates for longer environment on balance. But I think it does no harm to have a bit of kind of hedging protection on the periphery.
So what sort of percentage gold and where will you get that exposure? ETFs or which funds?
For me, tiny, not even, I don't know, probably not even 1% at the moment. You know, but I'm nibbling. Tell you what I'm doing. I'm just doing my kind of, you know, monthly averaging. I put a little, I've got a, one of my ISAs I've got with free trade. So it didn't cost me anything to trade. and I, every month I buy a little bit more gold, mainly gold miners, actually, to answer your question. Gold miners, Polymetal, Barrick and Newmont. I think Van Eck and iShares have got gold producer ETFs that actually do the job just as well, by the way. There's nothing wrong with them. You may as well go and do them as well. Physical gold, not quite there yet with physical gold. And the reason I quite like the gold miners is because actually you are picking up a yield and actually the balance sheet's actually not bad. I accept that physical gold has its enormous attractions. I suspect I probably wouldn't switch back into physical gold via an ETP in that case. Until a crisis mode when, you know, I'd probably want to do it. But actually, bear in mind, if you're going to do that, you have to bear in mind that gold miners and silver are much more leveraged plays on the things that I'm talking a bit about. So if you're going to do a leverage play, that's where you'd look.
And moving on to income, for those that want income from their investments with all the suspended dividends, you wrote recently about retail bonds. What are the benefits and what are the risks? It's a little understood area by most investors. So could you enlighten us a little?
Yeah, well, it's not a complicated idea. If you go to Italy, lots of ordinary retail investors have effectively retail bonds. They buy individual bonds. Whereas in the UK, we tend to buy bond funds. And there's nothing wrong with bond funds. You know, some very good bond fund managers out there. But retail bonds can work for some people where they've got, they've got a particular, you know, they might retire in 5 years' time, you know, and that's a five-year duration bond. And they've got a particularly high yield requirement. So some of the retail bonds that I wrote about in my FT column, you know, a lot of those are paying over 4% a year. I haven't checked in the last couple of weeks. They've probably gone up in price. So the yield's probably come back towards 4%. But you can, you know, it's not too difficult to buy 2 or 3 or 4 retail bonds, decent ones that I talked a bit about, and get a blended yield of about, you know, 4.5%, 4%. And then you combine that with some alternative investment trusts that produce an income. And I write about that in Money Week regularly. It's not too difficult to get a kind of blended bond portfolio at about 4, 4.5, and a blended alternative income portfolio at probably 4.5 as well. So, a 4.5, I think, with virtually zero interest rates, that's not a bad yield at the moment. So I think that retail bonds work for certain types of adventurous investors. That if you can't be bothered to do the due diligence and understand what's in the package, don't do it. Just get a bond fund. But they can work. The issue you've got to be aware of is that the bid offer spreads on them are truly monumental. So these are not trader vehicles. You do not buy in and out of them because you'll be crushed. So these are kind of buy and hold stuff, you know. So if you've got a requirement, you want five, you know, a lot of the bonds that I talked about are all due to mature in about 3 to 5 years. So you've got a requirement 3 to 5 years and you want to get 4.5% and you're happy to sit tight, then they're, you know, and quite often they're trading below par, which means that, you know, with a fair wind, you'll get a bit of a capital uplift, you know, usually kind of, you know, kind of 5p on the pound, something like that. For the right investor, that's fine. That's not necessarily a replacement for equity income, because equity income, it means many different things to many different people. So a lot of people, equity income is simply, I take the dividends because I like dividend-orientated companies, and then I reinvest the dividend. And obviously, these are not a replacement for that. And then there's a bunch of people who buy equity income because they want a good, juicy income, 4% a year, 3% a year. But they also want some capital upside. And again, these vehicles, by and large, some of the alternative investment trusts are okay for that. But these are not really aimed at that. These are aimed at people who basically want their capital back, by and large, and they want a return of about 4 or 5% a year. Now, for that crowd, I think actually these retail bonds can work quite well. The other area that I would think about looking at, and I'm probably the only journalist in the UK who still likes them, is structured products. Lots of people hate structured products. Lots of advisors hate them. But they've changed radically over the last 5 years. They're pretty much all sold now by IFAs, and particularly auto call structures. You know, you can be picking up kind of 5, 6, 7% return, distribution return from them, and on very decent kind of barriers. And they can work pretty well, as particularly as a replacement, not only for equity income, but as a replacement for absolute returns, which have been absolutely disastrous in my book. Absolute returns funds, absolute dog of a sector. So, yeah. So retail bonds can work for the adventurous investor. But for going back to your question, if you're an equity income investor and you're looking for a replacement for equity income, I'd suggest is a little bit of kind of long-term thinking. Yeah, the dividends will get cut this year and it is a bit painful. And if you're reinvesting your dividend, you sort of don't really care anyway. And again, going back to Andy Lapthorne over at SocGen, who's kind of the guru on all kind of equity income strategies, you know, even he says after you've basically removed all the people who stopped paying their dividends, and if you put reasonable assumptions about who will restart again in 2021, you still get back to a yield through the market of about 4%, yeah, and most of them will restart next year anyway. So if you're an equity income investor who's using it as effectively a proxy for equity growth, so reinvesting a dividend, you know, I think equity income's probably, you know, it's not gone away. You could probably sit tight. The thing you've got to be careful of, you just don't get stuck in the wrong sectors, really. You don't get stuck in, guess what, energy stocks, which look quite attractive because they're yields, but, you know, don't trust that yield. So you need a good equity income manager to navigate your way around it. And unfortunately, one or two of the big equity income managers, without naming any names, but their surnames begin with W and B, haven't done a terrifically good job of avoiding some of the blow-ups and have ended up investing in possibly stuff they shouldn't have invested in. So you've got to find a good equity income manager out there. Or just go for a kind of, you know, an enhanced income ETF that just systematically buys certain stuff and tries to enhance the income.
And with retail bonds, is there a risk that you might lose, the company goes bankrupt because they're raising the funds because they're running short of funds? Is there a higher risk with retail bonds?
Yeah, there is some risk with some of them. So, I mean, look, I studiously mentioned I got rid of virtually every one of my energy positions bar one, and the bar one was Premier Oil, which for narrow reasons I think is still interesting, and I still have retail bonds in that, and they crashed down to, I think at one point they were trading at 30 quid on the pound, on the £100, and because the market felt that the Premier Oil was going to go bust, a lot of debt, not a lot of money coming in, and so it's going to go bust. It's bounced back now to about 70 quid, I think. So yes, some of them can, you do run that risk. The ones that I talked about in the FT column, by and large, I don't think you do run that risk. So a lot of people issue retail bonds because they have sort of peculiar reasons why they can't issue established corporate bonds. So at one extreme, Burford, which has had its controversies and is now actually credit rated, but it's traditionally liked using retail bond structure because it's a bit alternative. LendInvest, which is a peer-to-peer lending platform, has got corporate retail bonds. Again, they do it for a particular reason. Do I think their portfolio will go bust? No, probably not. Some of the charities I talked a bit about, yeah, they could go bust. I think it's unlikely. They're usually senior unsecured. So there's no debt above them. So yes, that is a risk. And that's why I'm quite careful in my column a couple of weeks ago to identify the ones that I think that where the default risk, which is what you're talking about, Tamsin, is fairly low. There are definitely bonds with much higher default risk, you know. And if you look in the corporate bond fund sector, one of the things a lot of managers have got caught out on is they've invested in highly levered loans in quite often PE-backed, private equity-backed funds, structures, sorry, where there's a real risk of defaults and the market has priced in defaults. So, that's true for all bond investors.
And could you give an example of structured products that are sold through IFAs?
Yeah, I mean, you know, on my blog, I wrote about one, for instance, which is, I mean, Tempo, which is a guy I know very well, a guy called Chris Taylor. So a classic example, and they're all pretty much, the standard product is not particularly exciting. They do an auto call. So what they'll say is they'll strike at a certain level of an index, something like the FTSE 100. And they'll say, and if the FTSE 100 is at this level or above this level in a year's time, you get a return. You get for every £100, they'll pay £110 back. But there'll be a barrier, and you need to understand the barrier, which is why you need to be advised. It's an advised product. It should be an advised product. So you need an advisor who understands it. And the barrier will be that, you know, as long as, for instance, the FTSE 100 doesn't go below 30% of the strike level. So I don't know what the FTSE 100 is today. I mean, I don't track the market that much. But let's say the FTSE 100 is, I don't know, 6,000. And so as long as it doesn't decline by 30% below that 6,000, so that would be, what, 1,800, 4,200, you keep your capital. If it goes above 6,200 in a year's time, or a year after that, or a year after that, you get your, for instance, 10% return. And the reason I think they're quite interesting products, and by the way, they are very, very heavily used by big wealth advisors and private banks who use them for ultra high net worth individuals. So they are very widely used. They're a pretty good way of effectively getting a kind of absolute return profile from investing in equity. So you get some of the upside. They're not without risk, you know, as I've articulated the risk, which is your barrier gets breached. There's some risk around collateralization. So they're quite often based on options, and the options are issued by big investment banks. So you've got to be a bit worried about whether or not the investment bank goes bust. I think in the current circumstances, I think that a lot of the big issuers are systematically important global banks. And the regulators would be extremely keen for those banks not to go bust, and thus your collateral to be worth nothing. But I think for a lot of people, for cautious defensive investors, structured products work very well. And listen, it's not just me saying that. There's loads and loads of very high-end IFAs and wealth advisors who use structured products. The difference is that they used to be much more retail, and they were sold rubbish. Rubbish ones were sold by building societies, and they were absolutely dreadful products. One of the places I live, there was a high street building society, which will go nameless, and it's a county building society. And they used to sell structured products on their window, and I would go into them and have a chat to them about what the staff, if they knew what they knew about the structured products, and they knew bugger all about them, and they were dreadful products. So they've largely vanished from pure direct to market retail, and they've effectively become an advised product, and quite right too, because they are a little bit more complicated. But for the right investor, they're absolutely brilliant. They have worked really, really well for lots of investors.
Great. I'm going to open up for questions now, because otherwise we'll run out of time. And we've got a question now from Nilesh Shulka, who says, ever looked at well-managed active funds such as Fundsmith, Linsell, Train?
Yeah. Okay. The usual candidates, you mean. Everybody loves Linsell, Train. Everybody loves Nick Train. Maybe it's the contrarian in me that I slightly run away from anybody who seems such an overwhelming consensus favorite. Look, they're good managers, you know. I always laugh with Nick Train. I've met him a couple of times. I like Nick a lot, and he's clearly a very good fund manager. I often wonder what he actually does most of the time, because he doesn't do much trading on his portfolio. But So you're not going to go terribly far wrong. Although I would say, Terry Smith's main fund, Smith, has done very well, but his emerging market one didn't do terrifically well, an investment trust. They're great managers. I'm not going to try and talk you out of it. But you can read that in any other publication. Those guys just get written about by the Daily Telegraph and bloody Sunday Times every single week. So why should I bother talking about them? Because they get plenty of publicity anyway.
And Ewan Hughes asks, what are your views on house builders?
Yeah, very good question. One of the greatest trades after the GFC were house builders, weren't they? They did remarkably well. I have to be honest and say I haven't tracked them in great depth in the current sell-off. I'm guessing they probably sold off quite aggressively. All I'd say is that, so one of the funds that I sit on is a fund called Aurora, which is managed by a guy called Gary Channon from Phoenix. And Gary has researched the house building sector to within an inch of its life. And I have a lot of time for Gary. And he's been in and out of house builders for pretty much last 10, 12 years. And I always struck by what Gary tells me as a non-exec director on the board. We don't make a lot of land. The demand for new property is pretty insatiable long term. There's too many of us on our little crowded island. We all want to live in roughly the same places, and we all want a certain type of property. And the land banks that those big builders are sitting on are fantastic. So look, short answer is I don't think you'll go terribly far wrong with them. I don't track them personally at the moment, so I wouldn't know where their pricing is at the moment. But I don't think you'll go far wrong with them. I mean, you know, British, you know, what we've allowed to happen in the UK, which I personally think from a policy perspective is criminal, is we've allowed a bunch, an oligopoly of very big, very successful house building giants to dominate the house building market and build up phenomenal land banks and amazing profit margins. Now, and then we've allowed them effectively to squeeze out the small family builders. Now, from a policy perspective, I think that stinks personally. But from an investment perspective, that's a fantastic proposition. That ain't changed. So, you know, I don't think you're going to go far wrong with house builders.
So Howard Cousins asks, other than energy stocks, what other sectors should one avoid?
I don't think I would be sector-wide for anything else, really. For instance, classic example is everybody is desperately bearish about retailing. I'm not. I think some retailers would do pretty well and a lot would do pretty badly. So I think retailing is, I'm not a sector bear. I'm probably just an individual kind of subsector or bear. I'm probably bearish on certain bits. I'm not really bearish on anything. I suppose the only one I'd probably be a bit bearish on is, but I'm not really, it's nowhere near as savage as it is with energy. I am enormous bear on energy. I am a bit cautious around banks, not because I actually think they're going to go bust. As I said earlier, I don't think they are. I just think that I'm not completely convinced that they'll make a lot of money in the next few years. I think it's a very difficult market for them. They don't make much money in a zero interest rate environment anyway. Then they're going to face all these defaults. But eventually, you know, it will be priced in. And I think an amazing statistic I saw, which Morgan Stanley analyst pointed out, which is the European banking sector now is actually smaller in market cap than the European tech sector. And the European tech sector is a pale shadow of the American tech sector. I mean, it's tiny, you know, there's only about a few world leaders in there, you know. So that shows you how much European banks have fallen out of favor. So I'm not as viciously against bank stocks as I am energy stocks because they will find the price, yeah. And maybe the price is around now. A lot of people I know really like Lloyds Bank and they think it's, you know, a well-run bank and they think it's got a great position, you know. And they may well be right, but the problem is that it's a UK bank and the UK is going to look a pretty grim place over the next year, isn't it?
And Daniel Jordan asks, is there a central place where the structured products such as auto callables can be found?
That's a good question. There's a gentleman called Ian Lowes, L-O-W-E-S, and he is actually a very good financial advisor based up in Newcastle. And he runs a website that I think it's called Structured Product Review or something. Where you can get, I mean, it's aimed at IFAs, but, you know, ordinary people can use it. And he does a fantastic job of doing a kind of market overview, which a lot of advisors use. And if you look at my blog every once in a while, venturesinvestor.com, I write about structured products probably every other week.
And other than grid, are there any renewable funds that you would recommend? Kieran Clark asks.
I snigger because I have a column coming in Money Week this week, slightly laying into the sector. Yeah, look, yes is a short answer. I think you know the renewables group TRIG I think is just a very good solid play, a very good manager. The reason I sniggered is because there is a story going on in renewables which is and I sort of hinted at it already, which is as more and more renewables comes on, the marginal cost of producing every extra electron and it goes down the power grid is closing in on zero. It's not zero, but it's closing in on it. And the subsidies are being slowly withdrawn, offshore subsidies. We've already got subsidy-free offshore wind now. And what's actually happening is, and we're seeing it already, is that wholesale prices are declining for power. And that is producing something of a headwind for the renewables yieldco investment trusts. We call them yieldco because they're focused on providing a yield. And although a lot of them trade at a premium, so things like TRIG and Greenco, and there's a whole bunch of them, Bluefield Solar, Foresight, and they're all pretty well run, you know, it is producing a bit of a headwind for them. They were pretty over, I think they were trading at a big premium. Wholesale prices are declining. Subsidies are slowly but surely being withdrawn, and the marginal cost is coming down. And that there's all of those trends are secular trends that will last for the next 10 years. And they do provide a difficult trading environment for, no, it's not difficult, it's not, that's unfair. They provide a headwind for a trading power now. Now, a lot of these are on long-term contracts, so they don't care. So they can, but unfortunately, a lot of their financial models are based upon discounted cash flow models and kind of intrinsic value models and all sorts of models that the wholesale prices have an impact on them. And they have to price it into their models. And we have seen some NAV declines in the last 3 months. So I think you're probably better off doing, and this is what my Money Week column is about, is there are a couple of funder funds out there, Foresight and Gravis, both do infrastructure funds that invest across infrastructure renewables. And they invest in a whole range of investment trusts, and they're actively managed. And I think if you're going to put a big lump of money in the sector, that's where I'd probably look. So Gravis VT UK Infrastructure and Foresight Infrastructure. I have a slight kind of, I've got some, my criticism, which is in Money Week, this coming out this week, about how successful they've been, that they've gobbled up large amounts of money and they're quite important and systemically important in the infrastructure space. But I think for the average long-term investor, I think you can probably afford to ignore that if you're sitting tight. And they'll provide you a nice, decent yield of about 5% a year.
And Monica Hersey asks, how will Brexit affect your investment strategy?
I was dreading the word Brexit. The reason I was quite bullish on UK assets at the end of last year and the beginning of this year was I felt that UK equities, particularly domestic exposed equities, had been hit quite badly because of concerns on the international markets around Brexit. And therefore, they were priced at really decent levels. And I was quite bullish, particularly UK mid-cap and to a less degree small-cap. That's slightly been overtaken by events, although I'm sure Brexit will rear its beautiful or ugly head, depending on how you look at it. I think there is, look, I may as well not beat around the bush. International or institutional investors I talk to a lot, are still pretty damn worried about a no-deal Brexit. And you're sort of seeing it already in the cable rate, the sterling dollar rate. It's pretty weak at the moment. And bounced back to 130. I can't remember what it is, about 122 at the moment. And when I talk to big institutional portfolio managers, which I do, and strategists, they go, the UK is pretty, UK domestic equities are pretty underowned by international investors. There's a very low percentage. They noticed that a lot of those big international institution investors are still holding back because they are still worried about a no-deal Brexit. So that could be an opportunity or a risk, depending on how you look at it.
And Rebecca Stewart asks, you've mentioned a few publications that you read. What would be your top five newspaper, magazine, or newsletter picks for the retail investor?
Obviously my blog. No, but and obviously all the publications I write in. I think CityWire and Money Week, it do a fantastic job. I think Investors Chronicle does a fantastic job, but it's very, which might be all right for this audience, very stock pickery based. So it's very stock picky, whereas Money Week and CityWire are much more broader fund based. Newsletter wise, that's actually quite tricky. I'm lucky that I get a lot of kind of big bank strategy stuff, so I don't have to go down the newsletter route. I find most of the really good newsletters come out of America. They're all, unfortunately, a bit expensive. So there's things like, Jim Grant's Interest Rate Observer. Richard, there's an actually American, but he's based in Singapore. Richard Duncan, I can't remember what it's called now. So just put in Richard Duncan. He runs a video newsletter service that is extremely good. I think he's usually pretty damn smart. John Maldin, Mauldin, he's great. There's a Texas, Dallas-based IFA. Well, they call them IFA, and it's called RIA. And it's by a guy called Lance Roberts. He's very good. I find him a little bearish, but he's extremely good. And his kind of market overview stuff is second to none. Alphaville on the FT's website is great. And if you want to get really good market moving stuff, Alphaville is a brilliant place to go. Yeah, that's probably where I have a slightly different stream of stuff that an awful lot of people can't get their hands on. So it's a bit difficult for me. But I hope that answers that question.
Jay Shaw asks, what do you make of MTU or Japanese funds?
The problem with Japanese funds is Japan's a curious beast, actually. On many levels, Japan is really interesting. And I bet most of your listeners didn't know that the single most best performing index in the last 3 months has actually been a Japanese index called the Mothers Index. What a great name. And it's got an abbreviation, the acronym is something utterly ridiculous. But it's effectively a Japanese small to mid-cap tech growth orientated index. And it's, I think it's gone up by something like 80%, you know. I mean, it's an astonishing rebound. And Japan also, paradoxically, has probably more dirt cheap value stocks than anywhere else on planet Earth. Yeah. So if you're looking for some of the most interesting tech stocks are there. So there's robotics, which I think is another brilliant long-term thematic play. A lot of the best businesses coming out of Japan. But equally, there are lots of businesses that are, there's the classic American investor, Ben Graham, and he came up with a term called net nets, Graham net nets, which are companies that trade below their net asset value and trade below their cash. So they're actually less than their cash. And there are virtually none of these net nets anywhere apart from Japan. There are loads of businesses in Japan, good businesses, really solid businesses that are trading for less than their cash. So Japan's a very interesting place. The problem is that Japan is a tricky place, quite volatile. The yen can move against you and wipe out your gains. You have to have a very good active manager who knows what they're doing. And you need to just be aware that, you know, all those net nets can stay cheap for a very long period of time. So it's a tricky market. I actually quite like Japan, but the problem, I'm quietly reluctant to recommend it or suggest looking at it, is I've suggested looking at it in the past and it's gone nowhere. It's a tricky market to sort of get your head around.
I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. As I say, there are other questions, but we haven't got time for them. But that was tremendous. David, can you tell people where they can find you?
Okay. Well, go to my blog, which is adventurousinvestor.com. Go to my columns, which are every few weeks on the FT, Financial Times, Adventurous Investor, and CityWire. I write most weeks. And I write most weeks for Money Week as well on the funds section. So CityWire, Funds Insider, Money Week, adventurousinvestor.com and the FT.
Thank you very much. And thanks very much for a tremendous webinar. If you want an email notification of webinars or events PI World are organising, please sign up for events on the right-hand side of the homepage at PI World. There are two boxes, the top two, sign up for a notification of a new video as it's published, and the one below, sign up for events. Different lists, no spam. And do tell your investing friends about PI World and write comments or like our videos on Twitter, bulletin boards and YouTube. We like to go on providing these free webinars, and getting really good speakers like David relies on you and the audience number we attract. And you can find me at Tamsin PI World. Many thanks to you all for joining us, and stay well. Goodbye for now.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.